It's time for the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast, answering your questions from the General's Quarters every week, right here on VolQuest.
Hey, good Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome to the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast. I'm Eric Kane, alongside Brent Hubbs, Austin Price, and Grant Ramey. This podcast is presented, as always, by our friends over at Exterior Home Solution. They've been local and trusted since 1999. If you have a need for roofing, siding, windows, or a garage, you can contact Exterior Home Solutions today. That's at 865-524-5888 or online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. Got a lot of questions today. Going to work our best to get through as many as we possibly can. Several questions about Mike Matthews. So, Austin Price, I'll give the floor to you. Do you have any type of update on the timeline for Mike Matthews?
Well, we said here on Thursday morning, and unless something has happened in the last little bit, you know, Mike will go into the portal, I believe, sometime this morning. And when that happens, I think, you know, his chances of coming back are slim to none. I think that's tracking to him being at a new school next year. Obviously, you know, again, we're taping this, but I mean, as of early Thursday morning, you know, he could change his mind, have himself not put in, but had not done that the last I checked before we taped this. And so, you know, for Mike, you know, obviously, you know, had some kind of questions about, you know, things, and I'm sure he wasn't really happy with kind of how his freshman year went, but he was a freshman. And I mean, that's the biggest thing is, like, I think it's just hard when you look around, Jeremiah Smith's doing this or Ryan Williams is doing that, but not all freshmen are made equal. Look at, you know, I mean, Jalen Hyatt won the Biletnikoff Award the year before he won the Biletnikoff Hover. I mean, no one would have predicted that. He had, you know, minimal production. So I think, you know, for Mike, you know, it's all about, you know, kind of trying to find his piece and figure out what he wants to do.
All right, we'll move on to a revenue share model question. With revenue share still being possible for Tennessee to be, will it still be possible for Tennessee to be an all everything school if we do keep feeding into all sports? How big of an advantage is it for football or for other sports with some of the other schools focusing on just one sport?
Well, I mean, I think it creates challenges because where does the market stop from a financial standpoint? You know, if the revenue share model is $22 million, are you putting $15 million into football? Are you putting $18 million into football? Are you putting $13 million into football and everything else? I think, granted, it's a financial balancing act. And then how much are you being able to supplement those numbers for sports based on what your collective gets done? And then with the House settlement, if it goes through, what does that look like in terms of how viable the marketing deals have to be for the NIL money to be validated as opposed to maybe where it is now? Is that realistic that there's an enforcement staff for that? I think there's a lot of unknown. And the current model that it's in right now, as much as it's costing, I think it's going to be hard to be great in every sport financially through NIL because it's just really expensive.
And I don't think that's the end of the world. I think Danny White wants to be an everything school. I don't think Tennessee fans, like, it's a football school. It's a football school first and foremost, obviously. I don't think they want the baseball program to be a dumpster fire or basketball or whatever, and they had the time of their lives watching a baseball team win a national championship in Omaha in June. And the basketball team's ranked number one, 13-0 and all that stuff. But at the same time, like, it's football. I mean, that's what it is. Like, somebody asked, I was doing a radio thing before Ohio State, and the host asked me, Tennessee basketball is ranked number one. How many losses would Tennessee fans trade for a win at Ohio State, a football win at Ohio State? And I said 31. Like, they would go 0-31 in basketball if it meant they were advancing in the college football play. Like, I think that's the, not to disrespect the other sports, but let's just be honest about what's the most important here.
Yeah, and I'll say this too. I've had this conversation with Danny White, and they believe they can be an everything school. That they truly believe that they can be an everything school. We'll see. I think the question is, Austin, how far a football roster is going to go financially? Is $20 million going to become $30 million at some schools around the country? Is it going to go 35? Is there a number where there's some natural guardrails that come into place? I think that's something we're all paying attention, or I'm paying attention to here over the next year or two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's probably unrealistic to be an everything school. I know Danny wants to be that. They've kind of built their whole brand off that stuff. But I mean, like, there's only so much money to go around. And so, you know, if you're upper echelon football schools decide to go all in on football, and they don't care about men's basketball and baseball and women's basketball and so on and so forth. If Tennessee's trying to be really good with a football number, but then also give some to basketball, give some to baseball, give some to Lady Vols, you're falling behind. I mean, I'm with Hubs. If there's a hard cap on this and that and all that, you know, and then it comes back down to like regular marketing dollars that, you know, that a kid can go out and get, or a Tennessee's collective or Georgia's collective or whoever can go out and get, then that's different. That I do think there'll be an enforcement committee on, like, you know, what's a real deal and what's not, you know, but then, like, then it comes back down to, like, hey, do you have donors that have businesses that will give to such things? And then all of a sudden, you know, like, let's say there's a guy that owns 17 Taco Bells in Birmingham, Alabama, and he wants to, you know, sponsor Ryan Williams, you know, and then all of a sudden Ryan Williams is all over the Taco Bell ads and in the, you know, central part of Alabama. Like, that's a real deal, you know, and it's going to come back down to, like, your donors and what they're willing to do from a marketing standpoint with the businesses they have. So, I mean, I think it'll be hard. I mean, I'm not saying it's not doable, but I do think if somebody decides to go all in on football, trying to do this and that with other sports is going to make it really hard for your football program.
Yeah, here's my last thing to you, Eric, too, is, I mean, do you have to have the highest payroll to win? You know, I mean, the perception is, yes, right now you have to have the highest payroll to win. Right now, the reminder to everybody is that there's some $20 million payroll teams that didn't make the playoff, you know? So the question is, where's the number? What's realistic that you need to be a playoff caliber football team every year?
And what's your model? I mean, like, Ole Miss goes straight to the portal hubber.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And you know, they were still a good football team. You know, like Florida State went straight to the portal. They were a dumpster fire because of the, you know, a myriad of different reasons, quarterback selection, whatever. You know, what's your model? I mean, are you trying to balance it? Because I think that's important too, is, like, you need good coaches that can develop. So that means you maybe don't have to have the greatest number of NIL. Then you also need team chemistry. I mean, are you building it through the high school ranks and sprinkling in some portal guys, or are you just going straight portal and sprinkling in some high school guys? I think kind of your model makes a difference too.
We'll move on now to QC Vol. The 2023 recruiting class finished 12th nationally and seemed like the signees had potential to perform at a higher level collectively than they were ranked. Looking back now, what grade would you give that signing class? I'm going to, here on YouTube, I'm going to share the screen with the 23 signing class so everybody can see. And so AP and Brent and everybody can see. That's obviously the class with Nico and David Hobbs, Nathan Leacock, Caleb Herring, Arian Carter, Cam Seldon, Jordan Matthews, Ethan Davis, Sham, Ricky Gibson, Tyree Weathersby, Larry Johnson, Shandavian Bradley, Jalen Smith, Emmanuel Okoye, Nathan Robinson, Khalifa Keith, John Slaughter, Christian Conyer, Jeremiah T. Lander, Bison Lane, Trevor Duncan, Jack Luttrell, Aiden Bussell, this is a big class, Nate Spillman, and Deshaun Bishop before you get into the transfer. So,
hey, the bigger thing is, how many of those are still here?
I was going to say, I mean, a number of those guys obviously are not here.
Well, and that sums up where the transfer portal is right now. I mean, that's what you're talking about. I mean, guys who are leaving, you know, AP, you've talked about this, and I think it's probably a year earlier. It's probably your freshman year in basketball, Grant, but I think in football, if somebody's not doing something after their second year, they're probably not staying around very long. Now, maybe you don't want them to stay around very long at that point. You need to move on. But if guys aren't making an impact after 2 years in football, the patience are about gone there. You know, I think there's still a lot of production in that class. I mean, I don't know that I would dramatically change its ranking from where it was coming out.
But this is exactly why I said, I mean, like, I continue to say, look, I get it. You want to be ranked 2, 3, 4, number one, whatever. But, like, look at the people that, I mean, like, that's a 12th ranked class, which is, you know, solid, you know, not upper end, but it's not sure not the bottom. Like, and how many people have already left? I mean, like, Hubbard, that's why I don't think you can really, like, you don't, that's why I just don't think you can just get so caught up in, in rankings of classes, because I think what you do in the transfer portal matters, and that's not weighted into a particular class.
Well, it's hard to put a lot of stock in my opinion, and anybody else can jump in here if wants to, because it's just so transient. You know, anybody can move it at any point in time. I mean, it's ranked fifth in the country. Well, you got some impact players, and then you've got some young players, Grant, in a year or so, year or two, maybe three, that you think are going to be starters, that are going to be really quality players. Those guys aren't hanging around to try to be those guys. They're moving on to somewhere else, which makes it to the point that the value of on signing day, it being a top five, probably is not what it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think the perfect example of that, Grant, would be to pull up those teams that finished in the top five the last couple of years, and how many of those teams have half their class obliterated by the portal.
I think, and maybe I'm crazy, but everybody thinks, I think money is the be all end all, and how much money you're going to spend and how much money do you have and how aggressive you're going to be in the portal and all this. I think evaluation is more important now than it's ever been, because you're trying to evaluate value on certain guys. Like, this guy is going to cost this much. Is he going to be patient? Is he going to be here in a couple of years? Is he going to wait his turn? Is he going to be Cam Carr and leave in the middle of the year because he's not doing something after a year and a half in the program? Like, I think evaluation now is more important than it's ever been, because you're trying to, you know, you're spending a certain amount of money. You want to get, you know, the bang for your buck for every single player you get, and get these guys that are going to stick around, and you're not having these classes where you're reading a list and you're thinking, man, I forgot all that about that player even existing until Eric just read that name. Like, you, and I think evaluation now is more important than it's ever been.
And I'd like to get them to the field.
Well, and I would like to see, and we can't, Eric, because there's no transparency with it, but I'd like to see what the NIL number is for all the playoff teams. Now, we know Arizona State's is low. We know Boise State's low. Nobody talks about Penn State. Like, I don't know how, I don't have a clue how much money Penn State's spending or not spending. They may be spending a boatload. They may not be spending a whole lot. You know, they're never really talked about in that world. I look at Illinois. I mean, Illinois is the anti-current day model right now. I mean, they've got, unless a bunch of guys leave, they're going to be as old of a team in college football next year and have a chance to make some noise in the Big Ten, because their model's a little bit different than everybody else's model. They've had some guys hang around, and they've developed some players for whatever reason. Some guys that wanted to stay in Champaign.
ETSU Vol, how do you determine if a wide receiver is best suited for the slot or the outside? Grant Ramey, you were a speedster in the slot, right? Give us a breakdown here.
I played on the other side of the ball because I did not have the speed. I was playing corner because I ran backwards faster than I ran forwards, if that tells you how fast I was going forward.
Great hips.
Right. I mean, lanky, taller guys are going to go on the outside. The smaller, shorter guys, the more twitchy guys, the better athletes, I guess. The better quick twitch, you know, whatever athletes are probably going to play the slot. I think the taller, lankier guys that played basketball growing up are going to play outside. I don't really know the exact specifics they're looking for, but I think that's where I'd start.
You want everybody to be physical, right? But they really right. want some physical presence on the outside.
You know, what year did you graduate from Sullivan South, Grant?
2006. When it was still open.
Yeah, Nick wasn't Alabama yet. I was going to say, so you're telling me a young guy from Rainsville didn't go burn. I mean, that kid's got some stiff ankles.
A lot of bone density. You know, Jalen Hyatt's the anti-slot for what you think, right? Because he was a tall, lanky guy that doesn't make, you know, looking at him, you would say outside guy, not inside guy. But they used him to their advantage as an inside guy. So I think you can do it different ways, but typically you want your inside guy to be more of a wiggle guy. More the Bayless Jones type player. Yeah,
Bayless was a great slot receiver in this offense. Mm-hmm. And that's why I thought, like, with the injuries and the opt-outs and all that heading the play. And I know, you know, it's easy. You can't just, I mean, you're in the playoffs. It's not like you can, you know, redo everything. But I thought, like, Brew McCoy made a ton of sense in the slot. Just throw it to him, you know, possession, like, move the sticks guy, underneath guy, bowling ball guy. Use him like they use Bayless. I know the speed's not the same. But I thought Brew in the slot would make a whole lot of sense at points and times this year. We'll stay with Grant here with this one. Ron wants to know, I've heard Rick Barnes can make a grown man cry without even cursing. Give me your best Rick Barnes teardown story.
One day, if you remember Lou Evans, way back in the day, Utah State transfer, I guess it was on Rick's second team. And Lou's a good basketball player, helped this team, helped the program a lot when he was here in terms of they needed somebody like him to come in and produce. And one day at practice, he just looked at Lou and said, you think you're a good basketball player? You're not. And that was it. And Lou just looked at him like, what am I doing here? There's a guy on Monday morning at practice, a player that's been here for a while that Rick loves. He said something to the player. The player didn't kind of yes, sir, no, sir, and back. And he said, you're not good enough to have that kind of attitude, and told him to go run stairs. So he went and ran stairs. And, I mean, that's every day with Rick. He goes after players like that.
So he made Rob run stairs.
Did y'all watch Rick's post game? What was it, Tuesday night after Norfolk State?
I saw the picture from Party City.
Well, the press conference in, and Rick goes, so what's everybody's New Year's resolutions? He just starts kind of going around the room. He goes, what about you, Rob? And Rob just sitting there. He goes, Coach, I want to cover Tennessee in a Final Four. And that was it.
That's when it ended?
And Rick was like, all right, let's do that.
All right, moving on. We'll go to Wise of All 24. If the OC stays, what differences will we see in the offense next year?
I mean, I don't know what the evolution and the next generation of the offense is going to be. I've said it repeatedly. I think that you've got to have a counterpunch to the way people are playing you on the back end. I think teams are more committed right now than ever to let you, within reason, run the football. As long as you're not ripping off 40 and 50-yard runs, 30-yard runs, they're going to let you run the football, and then they're going to try to make it hard on you in the red zone. And I think you have to find a counter to teams saying, we're not going to give you, you know, press coverage out there where you can run switch routes and get, you know, 5 yards in the clear. There'll be some of those. We saw some of that this year, but for the most part, I think teams are saying, you know what, we're going to do a better job keeping the ball in front of us, make you drive the length of the field, and see if we can win in the red zone. And that's what teams did to Tennessee. Eric, you had that in your resolution piece on New Year's Day. That's exactly what teams were doing to Tennessee. This is as effective running team as Tennessee's had by the numbers, but the lack of explosives was very obvious. And I mean, your lack of touchdown production in the red zone was down 25%. From 2 years ago. And I mean, that's a touchdown a game. That's a big difference.
Yeah. There's a number of different areas you can attack this. I think touchdowns in the red zone is the touch efficiency in the red zone is a huge one to point to. Penalties both on both sides of the football, something to point to. Again, just the downfield passing. I mean, Tennessee's still taking the shots, but if you look at the numbers, I mean, what Nico and Joe completed in terms of what Hendon completed in 21 and 22, which is obviously not where it needs to be. And so, self-scout, we've been saying it a lot the last couple of weeks, and I think I mentioned self-scout about 17 times in that resolution piece. I mean, there's a lot you got to look at, you know, in this offseason, both from an offensive and a defensive perspective. Let's go to Blayton K. We kind of talked about this a moment ago, but after watching the Ohio State game, one of the most obvious issues was the talent gap Tennessee has to elite programs in college football. How does Tennessee go about closing that talent gap when we've entered a world where kids are constantly transferring or figuring out how to retain your roster year after year?
I was going to say, I think the talent gap keeps getting dispersed out amongst all of college football. So I think everybody's the parity of it all gets greater and greater every year. So, I mean, you know, that's a great question. I mean, you got to recruit better, you got to develop better, and then it comes down to money to hold on to some of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, Grant, I don't think Ohio State clearly had more talent. I think the talent gap was probably magnified by the fact that I think Tennessee walked into a hornet's nest there. I mean, I think the worst thing that happened to Tennessee is the Michigan game. I think that probably gave a bit of a false sense to everybody about where Ohio State was. And on the flip side, it got Ohio State right, you know, for that game. Plus, it was up there. It was cold. I'm not saying Ohio State's not better than Tennessee. They've got more dudes than Tennessee has. They've got more NFL stars on that roster than Tennessee has on their roster, no question. I think some of that was a little bit magnified, too, by the fact that that was a very well-prepared, highly driven Ohio State team that was pretty embarrassed by what happened to them the last time they were on their field.
I mean, I think you look at it and you try to build what Ohio State has built. I mean, look at that offensive line and what it did with Will Howard in that game, and look at those receivers and the plays they made. And it wasn't just Jeremiah Smith; it was all those guys that were making plays, and the options they have at running back, and they've got Chip Kelly calling plays. Like, you better be aggressive and recruit at an elite level and retain at an elite level, evaluate at an elite level. You better have an elite coaching staff. Like, if you want to be elite, you got to be elite in a lot of different categories to compete with those kind of teams. But I do agree, too, that it was a little bit of circumstance in terms of how motivated Ohio State was in that moment.
I do think it's disappointing because I think when Ohio State is at full strength, that offensive line truly is elite, okay? But you were missing two NFL guys in that game. Your center was not a good center that Tennessee played. That left guard was not a good left guard. That right guard wasn't any better. I mean, there was ample opportunity there, and unfortunately, Tennessee just didn't take advantage of that in terms of pressuring the quarterback, and that kind of leads us into the next question. Vols5790 says, Nick Saban said on game day prior to the OSU game that our defense is basic and doesn't present a lot of exotic looks. Also on game day, mentioned that OSU said our defense looked susceptible to the wheel route, which they ran in the first quarter for success. Are we relying too much on winning one-on-one on the defensive line? Is it too easy for guys like Carson Beck and Will Howard to read?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, Tennessee was known for their defensive line this year, and I think they kind of felt too comfortable with it, Hubs. I mean, if you watch any of these bowl games, I watch Michigan and Alabama, and, I mean, the pressure that Michigan brought from the second and third level was, you know, next level. And then you get into the Penn State game, same thing even with Boise State. I mean, they're bringing guys from all different directions. I didn't feel like Tennessee did that at all most of the year, especially against Georgia and Ohio State.
It absolutely did not.
They didn't at Georgia either.
It didn't feel like it. Apparently, 40% of the time Tennessee blitzed. It certainly didn't feel like it, but they absolutely –
skeptical of PFF, though.
Yeah, absolutely did not do it against Ohio State.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is you have to – by whatever means necessary, you got to get pressure on the quarterback. I mean, you can't let guys play 7-on-7, Grant. And in Tennessee's and their two biggest games of the year, where the talent level was either equal at best or subpar, Tennessee didn't do anything to make the opponent uncomfortable. And Carson Beck and in Will Howard, and as a result, they were playing backyard football in the passing game. So I mean, it's not like you're covering them on the shallow crosses and all those things. So I mean, light them up, right? I mean, you're going to have to be more multiple than what you were this past year. We'll see what that looks like. I mean, that's something for Tim Banks and the defensive staff to self-scout as well.
Yeah, whatever the problem is, you got to fix it, because they're too good in the other 11 games or whatever the number was compared to what it looked like in those two games. And obviously, those are the two biggest stages. That's what the lights are the brightest for those games, and everybody's going to remember those. You got to be better in those games.
Yeah, and here's the thing. You wonder if they fell susceptible to the previous game footage, right? I mean, Ohio State had a hard time blocking Michigan. I think we all agree with that. Think about Georgia's previous game before Tennessee went to Athens.
Ole Miss?
And they gave up 5 sacks. I mean, Georgia's offensive line looked like a train wreck down there. And then Tennessee plays both those teams, and those guys look like the one of the greatest offensive lines of college football when they played against Tennessee. So, yeah, I mean, you got to be better than what you were against those two teams for sure.
Vol_the_in_it_all. How many numbers do we actually have to work with in terms of the portal transfers? Reading the New Sentinel article the other day, currently it seems like we only have 3 scholarships before we get to the 83 limits.
AP, I don't get the sense that Tennessee's worried about numbers. Now, maybe you've got a different view on things. I don't feel like Tennessee's in a position where they're going to go, well, we're going to that's a really good player in the portal, but we're not going to be able to take him because we don't have the number for him. I don't get the sense that that's the case. Maybe you got a different beat on it than I do.
No, fans need to quit counting scholarships, because fans have counted scholarships of guys that are walk-ons. Like, they'll be like, you know, Nate Spielman. I'm like, no. You know, I mean, like just quit counting scholarships. Quit worrying about things that just don't matter. Like, Tennessee's going to add who they need to add, and then, you know, they'll go from there.
With the tendency for young guys to hit the portal if they are not starting within 1 or 2 years, does it really make sense to continue to sign full recruiting classes instead of a smaller recruiting class that would allow you to go and get more proven players from the portal?
I think that's all what you want your model to be, Brent. I mean, you know, what do you, how do you want to go about it? Cause I mean, like, you know, high school kids, they cost a chunk in NIL. They're unproven, but you know, you get into the portal and it's probably gonna cost a little bit more, you know, than for a high school kid. And, you know, are you getting someone else's problem? Are you not? Like, I mean, not every portal kid's built the same. So, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's all what you want it to be.
Well, and I think it's always evolving, you know? I mean, I think that that's, you know, something that's always moving around and it changes a little bit. You also have to go back and have a core in place that wants to be here. I mean, I think I look at Tennessee baseball, I look at Tennessee basketball, and I mean, what's Tennessee got, Grant? Four new players out of the portal, something mm-hmm. like that?
Three starters.
But they've got a core of guys who are what I would call legacy players at this point. It's kind of how you would view it. I mean, they're true, you know, lifers in the program, you know. And I think baseball has had that, right, Eric? I mean, it's not just been, you know, just mass transient portal. And because of that, the culture that they have, some of those guys stay. I think that's where you're always trying to be is not have – you don't want to be a full free agent team every year. And that, you know, bringing in 18, 20 guys in the portal every year, you know, 25 guys. I think it's hard to have success with that. So your culture in your locker room to keep the core guys intact is paramount, in my opinion, to be successful.
I would go the other way, the question, and I would be signing big classes because – you know, the old viewpoint was you don't want to take somebody just to take somebody and tie up a scholarship for the next 4 years. Well, that's not the case anymore. That scholarship could be open, you know, a year from now. Like it's going to be, you know, they're not going to be sticking around the majority of these guys for 4 years.
In the spring after they sign.
Right. If they do, that's great because they're probably a contributor. They probably got a big role and they're happy and it's a win-win for everybody, but it's no longer the, we don't want to take somebody just to tie up a scholarship for the next 4 years. These things are changing hands every single year. So sign as many guys as you want, see how many guys hit.
Yeah. But sign more.
If you do that, you got to play them. You got to play them out of the gate and find out what they are and who they are. If you're going to go, because it's costing you money to put the class together too. Yeah. So you're investing money in that, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. I don't disagree with what you're saying, Grant, because you can find out and you're probably getting those guys a little cheaper out of high school, but you're still having to commit some money to them out of high school. You better play them.
Yeah. And maybe that's more of a basketball mindset from the way I look at it, because I've heard Rick say that in the past, earlier in the Rick Barnes era, where that's and you have fewer scholarships, obviously, so you got to make them count more on a basketball roster. But now, I mean, look at the situation you're in right now. You have what, 9 available scholarship guys because you left 2 spots open. Well, you got to retire that thought of I'm not going to take somebody, just take somebody. Fill out your roster so you can have the bodies in case of emergency, in case injuries, in case guys leave, whatever, midseason, so you're not stuck with a tiny rotation if stuff keeps happening.
I know we got to get a break, but Grant, I'm going to ask you this. Do you think there's more impact ready talent in the portal in basketball than maybe any other sport?
Probably because of just the smaller numbers and everybody's looking for, you know, the rosters are a fraction of the size. I don't think the portal percentages, I think there's still a ton of guys in the basketball portal, just like there are in the football portal. But sure. Football, you're looking for so many more numbers to fill out a roster. Well, basketball, you can go out and if you find 4 guys and you get 3 starters like Tennessee has, you can overhaul your roster overnight. And that's just a fraction of the total guys that are in the portal.
It feels like you can get a small school, mid-major guy who can have a huge impact in basketball, whereas football, it doesn't feel like there's that many mid-major, you know, lower-level impact guys. There's some. There's the Jared Verse stories that everybody loves, right? I mean, that's the one that you want. But it feels like there are fewer of those in football than in basketball, which makes me think there's more talent available in the portal in terms of impact guys that everybody can compete with, you know, by percentage than there even is in football. I think it's interesting to – I don't know if that's the case. I'd be curious to see kind of what those numbers look like. And maybe Tennessee's the outlier because it's Charlotte, Hofstra, North Florida. and it was Northern Colorado, right? I mean,
right. No.
It's not like they've gone and got A&M kid, or they've gone and got a kid from UCLA or something like that.
I mean, it's also just a numbers game. There's 360 whatever four Division I basketball teams, and obviously basketball is a very different sport in terms of physicality. Like, it's more skill than physicality, like football is. And football is just the divisions are, there's more separation in the divisions in football, and there's only, 138, whatever the number is, Division I football programs. And then once you drop down, that's a much bigger drop than going from high major basketball to mid-major basketball.
All I know is Eric Kane would have commanded six or seven, maybe three figures, coming out of Carson Newman, the transfer portal, back 12, 13 years ago.
Would have been better for, you know, I would have had an existing Lakeview Market deal, maybe a little Lisa's Country Kitchen, moving on up to
he would have got Waffle House gift cards.
All right, we'll continue the conversation here after this short break. Let's get a word from our friends over at Exterior Home Solutions.
Severe weather can strike at any time in East Tennessee, and Mother Nature can do severe damage to the first and most important line of defense that you and your family have against Mother Nature, and that is your roof. Whenever she strikes, make sure that you call the people that I call. Make sure you trust the people that I trust. And that's my friends at Exterior Home Solutions, because they're more than friends, they're truly family.
That phone number for Exterior Home Solutions is 865-524-5888. You can visit them online at exteriorhomesolutions.com as well. We'll stay with Grant here, stay with Hoops. Market Square Streaker says, wants to know, can the Vols contend for an SEC championship without Igor or Zakai shooting well?
If Igor keeps rebounding 8.5 a game or whatever his average is, and if Zakai keeps averaging 8.2 assists or whatever his average was as of the other day, sure, because they're affecting the games in other ways than just making shots. And I think they'll be fine. I think they'll shoot it better. I think Igor's 0 for 13 over his last four from the three-point line. Like, he's not going to do that the rest of the way. You would assume it's going to get better from here. I don't know if they beat Auburn without Zakai shooting it better and without Igor shooting it better. And I think it feels like Auburn's kind of in the driver's seat to win the league based on what we've seen through the first couple months of the season. But they can be in that conversation. They can be in the top four. I mean, it's a Rick Barnes basketball team that's going to be elite defensively, and they're going to be a top four team in the SEC, or contend to be a top four team in the SEC, and they should be a second weekend team in the NCAA tournament. That seems to kind of be the baseline standard, and it feels like this team kind of meets that description.
And it all of them boils down to matchups and kind of your path. I mean, last year, Tennessee probably makes it to the Final Four if they're not playing Purdue. If they're in any other,
If they handle their business against Mississippi State in the quarterfinal game, the SEC tournament, then maybe you get that one seed out west instead of the two seed in the Midwest, and you don't have to deal with Purdue.
There you go.
Wheels Deals VFL says, we're going to try to go after Mekhi Hughes, Tulane connection with Brazel. It's the Tulane running back that hit the portal.
Don't think so.
Say what, AP?
I do not think so.
Okay. The poster says, I'd like the running back by committee approach better than the one bell cow. That one bell cow is Dylan Sampson. I like that option better, but typically it's a running back by committee.
I don't think it matters. I think Tennessee, as long as they run the football, Eric, I mean, committee, successful. Bell cow, successful. Either way, Tennessee's done it at a high level.
Yeah, Tennessee's ran for over 2,500 yards all 4 years under Josh Heupel. 2,900 this year, second in the modern era of Tennessee history, most since 1951. Tennessee had a pretty good rushing attack in this offense, no doubt. Here's a question. Do you think the offense and defense add more plays to the playbook this offseason? Tennessee's recruiting more versatile players across the board, is more talented on all fronts, maybe less receiver splits.
You know, I don't think you're going to see less receiver splits. I think that's the core of where Josh Heupel is. I think you can change some route trees a little bit. I think you can do some more motion stuff. But, we'll see. The offense is Josh Heupel's baby. I mean, so what's the next gen? What's the next version of it? We're going to find out.
All right, let's go to Firebrown 1229. So with all the wide receivers leaving and some of the players saying it was a problem with the receivers coach, is that spilled milk and not because you're not playing or something like that? What's the story there?
The real question is what do the starters think? What does Brew McCoy think? What does Dante Thornton think? What does, Squirrel White think? Obviously, Squirrel left. I don't think Squirrel left for the exact same reason some of those other guys left, because Squirrel was playing. The ones that have complained at this point were not on the field. So you can make a case that, you know, I mean, normally when you're not on the field, whose fault is it? No one wants to say it's my fault. It's going to be the receiver's coach's fault. And it might be. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, you know, it's hard for me to just totally buy everything that kids that weren't playing are saying. Now, which goes back to my original statement, what do the starters think? And none of us know.
CN31 wants to know, Travis Smith, is he good enough to contribute in year one? Right now, as things stand, he's going to have to, right? Staff really seems to like him a lot. He looks really good. What do you think about Travis Smith?
Also? Yeah, again, Hub said this, you know, the last week and a half. These freshmen are going to have to start playing more. Like, the reason you're in the bind with Mike Matthews that you're in, as we said here on Thursday morning, is because Mike didn't play this year. Now, you could say, well, why didn't he play? Was he not ready? The coaches maybe thought he wasn't ready. It's the coach's call. I agree. But at the same time, how many times, Brent, in 25 years of doing this plus, has a coach been like, you know, I mean, it's the old, like, Jamal Lewis didn't know how to, you know, pass protect. You know? I mean, so he knows 90 or 80% of it. Well, he doesn't know that 10 or 20 could get us beat, so he doesn't play. I mean, like, sometimes you just got to throw him out there, which goes back to why I think, you know, Travis Smith and several of those players in this coming class, David Sanders, Marion Dye, they've got to play.
Well, and listen, I'll give the defensive side credit. Edwin Spillman hadn't played in 2 months, and he played against Vanderbilt. I mean, they put him out there. A year earlier, Arian Carter was in critical situations. You look at what they did with Boo Carter this year. I think when you talk about those young receivers early on, you got to package some stuff for them. Okay, maybe they don't know everything, right? Maybe they can't play every third down. It's not like in previous years, unless you do a change and you suddenly find a way to go tempo, and we see teams are having a hard time going to tempo, but you can take a guy off the field on third and six if he doesn't know your third down package. But if you've got three or four things he can run, you could work that in and get him acclimated and play him that way. I mean, I think you have to look offensively at packaging things for young receivers to get them on the field faster, as opposed to the you got to know everything before you're 100% comfortable because everything's a choice route and this, that, and the other. I think you have to look at doing that, not just with the young receivers, but with Boo Carter if he's going to play offense. You're going to have small packages for those guys that you build on as the season progresses.
And maybe, Brent, because they're doing the package stuff with Boo, it gives them, okay, well, let's do that with this guy or that guy, which goes back to what you're saying. Maybe that helps them.
Another question from CN31, Grant. Why don't we return kickoffs? They return more this year than they did that 1 year with Jimmy Holiday back there. But I think the easiest way to answer that is you don't have Velus Jones. Velus Jones was an elite returner. And if you don't have an elite returner, just take a knee, fair catch, and start at the 25.
Yeah, I mean, when they did return kickoffs, how many times did they get back to the 25? How many times was it like, okay, that was a good decision to bring that out?
Not much.
Like, until you have a dynamic returner, somebody that you think is going to break something off just about any time he touches the ball, you're better off, like you said, taking the knee and taking it to the 25.
10 Ken 1961, million-dollar question. Grant, we'll stay with you. If you're a college football commissioner, what steps would you take to improve the product? On the field is great. Off the field is a mess.
Well, there's this connotation with the NFL that it's going towards an NFL model, and that's the worst thing in the world. And it's not the worst thing in the world because you need a commissioner. You need a players' union. You need collective bargaining. You need multi-year deals that actually hold players to something. And you can still have all the pageantry and tradition of college football. That's great. That's not going anywhere because that's always going to be there with college football. But the current system's not working because it's a mess. Like the question asked, like the Wild Wild West system of there's no rules and everybody can do whatever they want. It's not working either. So and it takes a ton of work to get there. So that's where it needs to get to. I just don't know how it gets there. And I would go back to, you know, almost not division, like divisional conference play like the NFL, but you need more geographic conferences like the conferences were divided up before we got into realignment and all the stuff that we're in the middle of now. Like, you don't need Stanford, North Carolina playing a conference game, stuff like that. Like, you need
that Missouri game, big time SEC East rival for sure.
Right. And get back to 16, go eventually get to a 16 team playoff and base it on, you know, records and all that stuff and games you've won and, you know, the more objective stuff and the less subjective stuff. And I think this team's better than this team. And for whatever reason, the committee thought that, like, everybody kind of has a bad reaction when you say it's moving toward the NFL, but it needs to keep moving toward that. And you can still retain all the college pageantry and stuff that everybody's loved for all these years.
Players have too much leverage right now. I don't think they should lose all their leverage like they didn't have 3 years ago when they had no leverage, or 4 years ago when they had no leverage, but they went from zero leverage to all the leverage. And that freedom of movement right now is the reason why we're dealing with the chaos that we're dealing with. So how do you get that? I think it's what Grant was talking about with the NFL model. So I think it starts, you just got to take some of their freedom of movement and some of their leverage away from them.
Yes. I mean, not to pile on guys like Tyler Barron and Wesley Walker, but I mean, in the course of one off season, they got an apartment at Ole Miss. I think that they maybe potentially even still have, then decided not to enroll at Ole Miss, went to Louisville, went through spring practice, and then went to Michigan and Miami respectively after spring practice. Like that, like the moving around, I don't know how you really like curtail that, like really slow it down or whatever. But like, I think if you sign a deal in January, it's got to hold you through. Like this whole, like, you know, like Boo Carter, you redo your deal in December. Like, you're not eligible for the spring window to try to, you know, potentially get more money, or Arian Carter, same thing, or Jermaine McCoy or whoever, right? It doesn't matter who the player is. The point is, like, you know, when you redo some of these deals, like, there's nothing holding you to it where you don't try to leverage in the spring window for that week.
Yeah, and again, I think it's even more year to year. I mean, I think Grant said best. I mean, there has to be some kind of repercussion for a player for leaving. And I know fans say, well, coaches can go anywhere they want to anytime. They can, but they all have buyouts. Now, the school may pay the buyout, but they all have a buyout. They all have a decision to make. You know, there's a financial part of that element of that. There's nothing right now to any of that. I mean, if you're at a place that you got an apartment lease and a car lease, you just walk in and say, I'm done, and you go to the new place and you get a better car and you get a better apartment lease and you get more money. You know, I mean, there's no accountability from that part of it. And listen, I'm for players getting paid. I don't want anybody to suggest that I'm not. But they have too much freedom and too much leverage in all this right now.
And it gets blamed on a, you know, a kids thing, and the kids are the problem. This would be the exact same thing in the NFL if you had year-to-year contracts and you could just move around. Like, if you go through OTAs with the Jets and you don't like it, all right, I'm going to go here and try, you know, the stuff later in the year with this team. If I don't like that, then I'm going to switch again. I mean, look at the NBA free agency. NBA free agency is a completely separate season in and of itself because of how much movement there is and all that stuff. Like, it would be the same exact thing at the NFL level if you had the same contract situations or lack of contract situations that you have at the college football level.
Yeah, if I was with the Jets too, I want to move on and you know, look for other.
The Bears would not have a roster. Nobody would want to be there.
Espen Vall, how aware? A lot of questions about, you know, the offense and the scheme and the self scout. Here's another one, but kind of through a different lens. How aware and willing is Coach Hopple to look at his offense and realize it's not working and make changes for next seasons? Many coaches are married to their system. They're not ready to make any changes, hoping Coach Hopple avoids that pitfall. I mean, Brent, he's aware, right? I mean, he knows that, like, this is not where it needs to be. So, you know, he's not going to ditch his system. He's not going to ditch his scheme. But what tweaks can you make? And I guess the question is he aware that he needs to make some tweaks?
Well, I'm sure he is. But here's, I mean, I don't think he's sitting there going, and I know fans are looking at it this way, but I don't think he's sitting there going, I need to just blow it up. And I need to put my entire offense in a shredder and start over. I mean, listen, you got to be better in the red zone.
There you go. That's the key.
I mentioned right there, I mean, if you're 75% in the red zone this year for touchdowns, like you were 2 years ago, then you average against power four teams, power five teams, you're averaging 31 points a game. 7 more points a game is what you would average against those teams. Okay. Also in those games, you have 13 drives where you got inside the 35-yard line and you come away with nothing. So it wasn't just a red zone. You're basically right there on the doorstep of field goal range and you went backwards. So you got to finish. You got to be a better finisher. The biggest thing for me that he has to look at is how do we become explosive again? Because the whole key to his offensive success everywhere he has been has been about explosive plays. It was that way at Missouri. It was that way at Central Florida. It was that way the first 2 years at Tennessee. What do you do to reinvent yourself or help yourself get more explosive plays now that teams are playing you different? What is the answer to that? And that's what Josh Heupel is tasked to do this offseason.
7 points a game, Hubs. And what do you get if you score 7 more points in Arkansas?
You win.
Which means you're what? You're hosting.
At home.
Yeah.
On the road.
I mean, there's lots of work to do, but you're also not a million miles away. Like I saw a post on the board, like the lost Ohio State set this program back for it. No, it did not. I mean, you're not that far. I mean, set back is when you lose to Georgia State at home. Okay. That's not where you are. Do you have to climb another rung on the ladder? Absolutely. But you're still on the ladder. You weren't on the ladder 4 years ago. It was in the garage. I mean, you weren't there.
To put it in golf terms, it's like breaking 90. Easy to break 90. Well, it's for some. Easy to break 90. You shoot, start shooting 81, 81, 81, 81, 80. What's it take to get to the 70s and to break through that barrier? And that's where Tennessee's at. They've kind of hit the ceiling of this taking it up another rung. How do they burst through the ceiling to get to that next level, which is where the team's playing minus the ones that got byes this weekend are.
Volunteer 87, if you were able to get a candid answer from Spire, do you think they expected the level of chaos, or do you think the madness of roster protection has surprised everyone?
No, I think they expected this. I think they understood that. They went into it with their budget, you know, having guys pegged at a certain number, knowing they were going to have to give, you know, they were going to give bumps. I think maybe it was higher than maybe they expected as far as just like the number, but they knew that there was going to be a lot of this, a lot of the chaos. Honestly, no matter who does that job, whether it's the guys at Spire, the guys at the, you know, Ole Miss Collective, Florida State Collective, Ohio State Collective, whatever, that's a thankless job because the players never like you because you didn't give them enough. It don't matter. You can tell them 1.2, they want 1.4. You can tell them 200,000, they want 300,000. You can tell them 50,000, they want 75. It doesn't matter. They're always going to be upset with the person telling them the number. And, you know, they get all the blame and, you know, maybe they get some glory too when you keep a kid. But, like, it's – to me, that job's a job I wouldn't want. I mean, it's just a lot of, you know, having to deal with a lot of people. And most of the people are not happy.
Imagine me and Brent Hubbs having to deal with us. That's why me and Hubbs have such an adversarial relationship, because he's never given me enough. I always want more.
I feel like Shane Beamer there, Brett Bielema. So thank you.
To which Matt Ray is saying, "Wait, y'all get paid for this?"
All right, we'll end on a series of questions here from Crayon. First one: how much does Heupel
love his handle, man? I just love it.
He always asks a silly question at the end, and I think he got tired of me not ever answering it, so he just stopped doing it. I did answer it 1 week. How much does Heupel work with quarterbacks one-on-one versus McKenzie and Halsley and what they're doing?
He works with them. I mean, I don't think it's as much as Militello, McKenzie Milton, or Joey, but he does work with them.
Would Heupel benefit from a GM position on staff? Brent, you and I have talked about that before. What's that position look like? Who's qualified for that position? But I mean, my answer just in blatant terms would be yes. I think you would benefit from that.
Well, it depends on how comfortable Josh Heupel is being a CEO.
Yeah.
Because the head coaching role in college football has always been about management. It's much more about management than it's ever been. And now you're talking about adding money in there and everything else that's in play now. It's not about designing ball plays. I mean, yes, you do that, but that's not at the top of the list. There's so much of a management layer to this. And I think if your head coach is not their greatest gift, or that's not what they like to do, then yes, they would certainly benefit by that. I mean, I think Dabo Swinney, long before NIL, benefited by Woody McCorvey helping him navigate things because of his experience versus Dabo being a young guy as a first-time head coach. So I think there's always that role. The thing about the GM role that has to be is that person has to be pretty strong-willed and be willing to stand up to a guy who's his boss, who's paying his salary, who's making about oh, I don't know, 10 times more, 12, 15 times more, 20 times more than what he's making. So, you know, and a coach has to be willing to embrace that. And every coach's situation is totally different. Just like every GM situation is totally different too now. I mean, this idea that you're going to go get an NFL guy to be a GM, I just don't think that's where we're at right now.
A former player, right? I mean,
yeah, a former player. I mean, that's just, I mean, again.
It might make sense for Stanford, but it wouldn't make sense for Tennessee.
Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, what do they want Andrew Luck to be? I mean, I don't have any idea what they're
Andrew Luck actually the shot caller? I mean, here's the deal. Most of these college coaches don't want anybody to be the shot caller but themselves. So I think, you know, like Alabama put $800,000 into their guy. To me, that's a waste of money. You'll never convince me otherwise. It's not a waste of money. I think that's just silly.
Well, and here's the other thing. Is in some ways the AD, the de facto GM? I mean, he's the one's going to tell you how much money you got outside of what's your collective, right? He's deciding your rev share number and what that looks like. I mean, how much more power does an AD have now? I mean, if he controls how much he's going to give you in rev share, doesn't he have a pretty strong voice with the head coach now, if he wants to, about how he thinks things should look or she thinks things should look? I'm with you. I mean, we're spending enough money as it is. I don't know that you need an $800,000 layer, $500,000 layer there, unless that person truly is going to turn to the coach and go, here's the roster we've assembled.
Yeah, there you go. And what college coach is letting that happen?
I don't know that a college coach is ready for that right now.
Are you guys in favor of reseeding as the playoffs progress through rounds? Yes.
Rounds?
Yeah, through rounds. No.
No. That's the start.
But should they seed and match up playoff based on your actual ranking? Yes. Because why rank them, right? I mean, the automatic, you know, it's infuriating.
I guess for me, like, I actually would be okay with that because, I mean, they kind of do that at the NFL model when, you know,
I would reseed it at 12 or 14 because you don't just have a straight 1 to 16 bracket. If it gets to 16, then I would just seed them as is 1 through 16 and leave it be. But if it's kind of uneven in terms of the 12 and 14, until it gets to 16, I don't know. But, yes, the NFL does it. I think it's fine.
Last one, do we see any more realignment or do we see a super conference first?
I don't know.
Realignment because it's still ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, listen.
Or to St. Clemson going.
There's a lot of layers to getting to a super conference. Because if you're doing a super conference, are you breaking away from the NCAA? I mean, there's a whole lot of litigation and things going there. It's not – we've seen it's not hard to go grab a team from another conference and bring them into your conference. That's a much easier thing to do than it is to suddenly say these 60 teams or 30 teams, Grant, or whatever, are breaking away from the NCAA and creating their own super conference.
I would lean towards they're going to break away at some point from the NCAA and do their own thing, the power, however many, four, whatever the number is. And when they do get that X number of teams, then they'll go back and divide it up geographically the way it was to start with. And it's going to be, you know, the Pac-12 rises again. There's going to be a, you know, all that stuff. Like, we're going to go straight back to all the stuff we had X number of years ago because they've broken away and they've formed their own thing. And if you can do that, and if you can, the NFL model we talked about and the conferences and divisions, let's do it.
Will Georgia Tech be back on Tennessee's schedule every year?
Right? Yeah, Sewanee, College of the South, right. Emory and Henry, Fort Benning. College.
You're talking about geography, and this is not that's regular season stuff. And I know the college football playoff is about strictly the TV cash, right? I mean, there's so much money in the TV part, but I mean, $40, $45 to get in a game to watch a semifinal football game, that can't be something that the college football playoff committee and the people in charge of the college football playoffs is. I mean, is that not something you have to have a self-scout, for lack of better terms, on when this thing is over? Like, okay, how do we avoid basically people walking into that game for bus fare, you know, at the end of the day? Like, how do we avoid that happening moving forward? Because the ticket prices for the games that have been played the last 48 hours, nobody's breaking. They're spending a lot more money to try to get there than they are to get into the game. For sure.
And they're going
to
be just as cheap next or in the next round.
I don't blame, like, think about Penn State fans. Like, do you want to go to the Fiesta Bowl, or do you think, man, they're probably going to beat Boise State, so I'm going to wait and try to go to Miami for the Orange Bowl? Or if you think you're going to win that game, you're going to wait. Like Tennessee fans, how many Tennessee fans thought, I'll skip Columbus if there's a chance that they go to the Rose Bowl, and I'm going to make that trip. Like, I don't blame fans for ticket prices being so low and demand not being there, because you're trying to figure out what you're going to spend your money on, which game you're going to try to go to, all this.
Yeah, that trip was going to be so expensive.
Well, and it's easy for Texas because, I mean, their next round, you know, if they win, is where?
Dallas.
In Dallas. Mm-hmm.
Well, and listen, I mean, Tennessee would have had – I mean, if Tennessee had won, then it's expensive to get to California. But if you keep winning, theoretically, you could drive – you could have driven to Dallas if you wanted to, certainly drive to Atlanta. So Tennessee could have had – three or four of them were drives. Penn State's got a home game, then it's Arizona, then it's Miami, then it would be Atlanta.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Oregon. Oregon's in Indianapolis for the Pac-12 or the Big Ten championship game, and then they're off for a week, and then they've got to fly to the Rose Bowl, and then they got to fly to Dallas, and then they've got to fly to Atlanta. It's expensive. And that's a challenge and something that I wonder what the committee thinks about that when you know, if you've got empty seats in college football semifinal games. We'll see.
Appreciate you guys for sending in your questions here. There's plenty more that we didn't get to, so do apologize, but great questions as always. And big thanks to our friends over at Exterior Home Solutions for being the presenting sponsor of the show. 865-524-5888 or online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. Hope everybody had a happy new year and a great time watching college football yesterday in the college football playoffs. For Brent Hubbs, Austin Price, Grant Ramey, I'm Eric Kane. We'll talk to you on the Journal's Quarters, and we'll have a great 2025.
You've been listening to the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast every week right here on VolQuest.